And welcome to the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, or perhaps one of our greatly appreciated radio syndicates across the country. Or perhaps you found us on the podcast, which you found anywhere podcasts can be found, including with the Harbinger Media Network, some amazing shows over there. Check them out if you have not. My name is Stefan Hostetter, and I am here with Mitchell Beer of the Energy Mix for our Energy Mix show, where we will recap the last month's energy news and some of the stories that we found interesting and answer listener questions. So again, if you have any questions, listeners, please do send us them our way. You can do so on the Green Majority website or by sending us an email or tweet at us. That's also something that we will check and respond to. Thanks so much for being here, Mitchell.
Are we still accepting passenger pigeons?
If we ever receive a pigeon, I will prioritize that question above all else. So, in the first section, we're going to talk a bit about our wonderful premiers here in Canada and their attacks on climate action, as well as a little bit about the carbon tax at the end. The second, we're going to do a brief foray into some solutions and talk about some actually positive things that are happening. And then, as we are want to do, we're going to end with whatever stories you, Mitchell, think are the biggest ones that we should be covering that we didn't cover the rest of the show. So with that, we'll dive into the one listener question that falls into that format, which is about the Alberta energy regulations. We covered that a little bit on the show last week. They are disastrous, I would say, for renewable energy in Alberta. 76% of Alberta is likely not going to be able to have any renewable energy because of these regulations, which is obviously a huge percentage. And the listener wanted to know how much of an impact this might have on Canada's ability to be a renewable energy powerhouse. Alberta was leading. They were getting the most investments. They were a leader in this. And so to have that leader be so uniformly shut down, what kind of impact should we expect that to have on renewable energy in Canada? What is your read on the whole situation?
Alberta has great solar and wind capacity, and some of the ways in which their grid is set up, I mean, there are obstacles, but there are obstacles everywhere. There are some aspects of the Alberta market that made it really interesting to renewable energy developers, and there was a lot going on. It is something that a lot of people in Alberta want. It's something that a lot of people in Alberta are working on and committing to. And as an Easterner, when I'm speaking to Easterners, I almost feel, you know, sort of baked in obligation to make that point, because I think it's a really important one. The backstory, as you were saying, is that the moratorium was laid down with no notice, no warning, no discussion in early August, because that's the way we do things. For 7 months, no renewable energy project over a megawatt in size, so a million watts of capacity, could be proposed or approved. Anything that was already in development could proceed, but they weren't taking any new applications. And all the attention was focused on this announcement that was scheduled for the end of February, about what the new rules would look like, what the new regime would look like. As you say, it is vague. It is still in development. 76% of Alberta, not Alberta as a whole, could be at risk of not being able to take on any renewable energy development. By the way, that would cost millions and millions per year in local tax revenues in the rural municipalities that ironically are a major part of the governing party's base in Alberta. So one of their backroom organizers might want to have a word with them. But the question you were asking as well was how this will affect renewable energy development across Canada. And what was really interesting in some of our interviewing, there's so many aspects to this, but one was an industry contact saying, you know, Alberta's in serious jeopardy now, because even in 7 months, the scene has changed. At the point when the Doug Ford government came to power in Ontario in 2018 and basically dropped a bomb on renewable energy development, they canceled 758 signed contracts, many of them with Indigenous communities, and they, in my framing, ripped a living, breathing wind farm out of the ground when it had been built and was about to start operation, and they tore it down, right? So at that point, Alberta ended up becoming the sort of the venue of choice, the venue by default, because Ontario had pretty dramatically abandoned the field. And that was still, to a large degree, the story at the moment that the moratorium went down. But it turns out that with things moving so fast in this space, thankfully, because we need them too. 7 months is a long time. And what this industry source was telling us was developers have choices. First of all, you know, a bunch of them decided to leave Canada and leave Alberta when the moratorium came down. One of them, as we quoted, called Alberta a banana republic, offensive as that term is in its original use. It was kind of interesting to see it used here. But now, 7 months later, there are so many other provinces. Nova Scotia is piling in. Quebec is piling in. British Columbia is investing massively. And for once, it's not all in you know, big hydro mega projects. So developers have choices. Developers have options. And even if they're based in Alberta, if they can't get a project going and they can get it going somewhere else, they'll go somewhere else. So it really is time for the Alberta government to decide the rest of Canada doesn't get hurt by this. In fact, Alberta has freed up capacity with this foolish, nonsensical, ideologically driven monstrosity of theirs. They've opened up industry capacity that can and will and already is going elsewhere. And again, finishing where I started, as an Easterner speaking to Easterners, this is not a gloat. This is not something any of us should be happy about. It's a tragedy for Alberta and therefore makes everything difficult for the rest of us too. But in the business sense, it's Alberta that stands to lose.
For all the things you can say about Dana Smith, she did not basically rip up a functioning wind farm, which as Doug Ford basically did do, and then got sued for it. So then had to spend money basically to make up for the fact that he'd already done so. Both Smith and Ford, I would say, where they come together is their belief in the idea that gas plants and gas energy is the way forward. That's pretty clearly what Smith is prioritizing, and very much from this next story, what Doug Ford is prioritizing, because the next story, which we also did cover briefly, but it's technical enough that I wanted to get your take on it, which is the overruling of the Ontario Energy Board and their ruling in regards to gas plants and charging for the gas hookups. So what happened here and what makes this so unprecedented, as your article states?
So one thing interesting that is happening in Ontario is that to some degree, they've got a big deficit to come back from, but the Ford government has been setting aside some of its baked-in ideology around renewables. They're starting to embrace renewable energy procurement again. They're starting to embrace batteries, particularly because they, you know, love the idea of all the manufacturing jobs and all the mining that they'll be able to get by building out those supply chains. So there are sort of longer stories and goods and bads in that, but it's not quite as it's more complicated now than they were making it in 2018, and that's actually a good thing. However, to your point, yes, their priority is on gas and nuclear, but the story with the Ontario Energy Board was that in December, through much or most of the year, they had been holding hearings on how Enbridge, which is our gas supplier in Ontario, how they would set their rates over the next period. And the OEB ruled in December that Enbridge would have to charge developers, who would then pass the cost on to households, for the full cost of their gas hookups at the point when they hooked them up, as opposed to collecting that money over about a 40-year span, 20 or 30 or 40-year span. It's expensive. So the reason that matters is that spreading the cost over a longer period of time amounts to an incentive to install new gas infrastructure at a time when we know we can't have any more. You know, the popular name of the product is natural gas. Climate hawks like to call it fossil gas or methane gas. And the reality is that the primary component of natural gas is methane, which is 84 times more potent a climate pollutant than carbon dioxide over the 20-year span that matters most, because that's the time we have left to get climate change under control. So we can't be installing new gas pipelines. We can't be installing new gas distribution networks and hookups. And yet, because of the way their business is structured, and I can get more into this if you want me to, Enbridge basically has an imperative to keep on installing new infrastructure. They will start to lose money as soon as they can't do that anymore. And what the OEB was saying basically was the way you are going to price those new hookups will basically reflect the real cost of installing them in a way that makes gas less competitive against the things that we should be doing, like lots more energy efficiency, heat pumps, essentially electrifying everything, electrifying heating and cooling, and you know, whatever appliances we have in the home. Enbridge had every existential reason to oppose that, even if all the rest of us have every existential reason to be in favor of it. And literally within days, you know, you've got to pity the poor energy minister, Todd Smith. You know, he wasn't getting any early break for his holiday season here. Within days, he said that the province was going to introduce legislation, and they have since, to roll back this decision by the OEB. And what is astonishing and unprecedented and really disturbing to regulatory watchers in Ontario is that the Ontario Energy Board is independent. It's supposed to be politically independent. It's supposed to take no sides, play no favorites. And for a few of the stories that we've covered lately, and in different contexts, I think we talked about the Solomon North Pipeline a month or two ago in Ottawa, I've heard people say at least two or three times, this does not mean that I always agree with the OEB. It doesn't mean we won't publicly criticize the substance of a decision if we think it's flawed. We will do that. But we're not questioning their process. We get it that they're honest actors, honest players. And that is so fundamentally essential to, first of all, give us a better chance that a decision will go right, at least some of the time or more of the time, and fundamentally to be able to have trust in a system that is not rigged in any direction. So if you're in a situation where people can spend probably thousands or tens of thousands of hours on a hearing process, you know, and rip up some more trees for all the paperwork they have to generate through that proceeding, come to a conclusion that actually brings us toward a cleaner energy economy, a safer climate, more jobs, all of the things that the energy transition delivers, and they get it right, and a politically motivated minister can just rescind that, that's at a process level what we're hearing even more serious than the very serious mistake they're making on the substance. Yeah. As I say, I can, you know, if you have 5 hours or 5 minutes, I can get into why it is that Enbridge is doing this, because actually it's not just Enbridge, it's Fortis in BC. I've heard that it's the gas utilities in Alberta, and we've seen this elsewhere. It isn't that they're being evil in trying to continue to install gas infrastructure. Their fundamental job is to stay in business. And because of the way that, I'm not justifying it, but from their point, because this shouldn't be done, but from their point of view, their rule number one is to stay in business, because anything else they want to do depends on that. And the way those businesses are structured, they have to do this because they can only keep going if they keep on adding infrastructure. So that's the core of the problem, but this is where it's brought us, that we are corrupting an independent process in Ontario.
Yeah, and that seems like a pretty big problem. Big parts of the evaluation of oil companies is the futures and the idea that they are going to pump out oil for the next 20 years. The idea that something is that is so fundamental to our current infrastructure, like Enbridge is sort of simultaneously too big to fail and needs to continue to grow, else it will fail, does feel like we're locked in to this world, right? Like,
doesn't it though?
It makes you feel like the only answer would be to fundamentally change the system, because we know that trying to solve the problem will make Enbridge collapse. Yet Enbridge is providing, you know, gas right now to customers who need it for the time right being right now.
Yeah.
So what do we do? Yeah. How do we even begin to imagine an electrified world if even beginning to lay the foundations for that leads to such a overwhelming concern that we have to get rid of the arm's lengthness of an agency? Like, at that point, are we just running? Or do we all work for Enbridge now? Are we just voting for Enbridge?
Let's have a look at their campaign donations. I have no idea what we'll find out, but I'm pretty sure it'll be interesting.
Yeah.
Whatever interesting means, let's get back, find out and get back to you. They're actually, this whole issue of getting from here to there, you know, we keep saying around here that we know the what. We know we need to decarbonize. We know we have the targets. We know we have the arguments in favor. We know in many places we have, you know, we have the programs in place, and some of them are pretty good. The how do we actually implement them? You know, after the years and decades that people have fought to get to this point, the how is actually even more complicated and has to get done fast and has to get done right. So yeah, that, you know, at the big picture, I think you've hit on one of the most, not the only, but one of the most fundamental challenges we have to grapple with and come out the other side. There is a story we're following, and we ran a first story on it this morning, and within a couple of hours of reader reaction, we knew that we were doing a follow-up because there was more to the story. The gas utility in Quebec, Énergir, hired, I would say, one of the best energy and climate strategy consultancies in the country to help them figure out how to get to real, not greenwashed net zero. For gas utility to try to do that, you know that the first cut's going to be imperfect, even if it comes from one of the best firms in the country. Because, as you're saying, there's no clean 100% flawless way for them to get there. Some of what they're doing, like emphasizing energy efficiency, because once again, they make their money on the infrastructure, not the gas. Great. Absolutely. You know, if they can drastically drive efficiency, that's an incredible contribution. Some of the things they want to do, like renewable natural gas, will depend on where the gas is coming from. If it's biogas at a farm, you bet. Absolutely. If it's, you know, some of the more greenwashed forms of at that point, so-called renewable natural gas, not so much. At the point when they say that they want to rely on carbon capture and storage, we've talked about that on the show, that, you know, the industry itself admits that the technology is not ready for prime time. So what I've been hearing, what we've been, our team have been hearing out and about, is that it's really interesting that Enercell is trying this. It's definitely to their credit that they're trying it. It's probably no surprise that it's not going to be perfect. And the way you get to perfect is to try something and find out what's working and what's not and get some practice and then keep trying. So it's not to suggest that the NHL plan takes the gas industry where it needs to go in one bite. And as I say, check out our Heat and Power Digest probably next week, next Friday, because I, you know, we've just started in on the update that we've been inspired by our readers to take on. And I won't prejudge where that's going to go, but it's a really interesting story. And it's so different from what we're seeing with a company like Enbridge, even though they're facing the same challenges.
Because we are recording this a week early, it will be out the day this comes out. So right now. So one more story before we go to music break, which is connected to sort of the ways that climate action is being hampered in our country, which is a throwback to something we talked about a couple of weeks ago or a couple of months ago, but you have a new sort of update about it. The Liberal government's attempt to figure out how to talk about the price on carbon. Obviously, it's become a central point of the attack from Polyev. It's been mimicked by premiers, conservative premiers across the country. There is a significant set of action from people here using it as sort of their number one sort of thing to hit. Like, axe the tax has become the sort of the number one unifying message, it seems like, from conservatives across Canada. And that's a relatively profound problem for the Liberals and for climate action in generally, because for all of its failings, a price on carbon was one of the major goals that environmentalists had for a long time. And so can you tell us a little bit about the challenges that Ottawa is facing and what there is to be done about it?
It really has been a lightning rod, as you say, and it's really been a problem for them. And something that I have not been able to figure out and have not been able to get any answers on is how did we come to a place where the government sets up a carbon tax, carbon pricing system, where the large majority of households, including those in greatest need, get more money back than they pay out, you know, so that it's intended and that should be revenue neutral, but to be a gain for most households in Canada. How did they get to a point where people don't know that? How did they get to the point where they were not communicating that on bank and credit union statements from day one? How did they get to the point where when they tried to communicate it, the references were so vague that nobody knew what they were looking at? We're a house of two-person household of climate hawks. And we haven't a clue when our rebate is coming in. We know it's there and we have confidence that it's real and we're happy to see it. I could not point it out to you on a bank statement, maybe now, because they have finally, years and years in, and years after this communications nightmare has had a chance to entrench and metastasize, now they're finally communicating it. And what I don't get, and I'm not trying to inferentially lay blame because I don't know where to lay it, but the people we see defending this in the news and defending it on the front line, they are very smart people, but many, most of them, but more to the point, they're skilled enough communicators to win a federal riding. Okay. And, you know, a comms person on a campaign can do a lot, but if your candidate can't string two words together or explain a concept, there's only so much you can do. Any communicators have ever worked on campaigns has been there and never wants to go back. That's not the case here when I look at the people who've been responsible for communicating this. So how is it that these just basic 101 mistakes were made? And I'm putting that in the passive tense because I don't know the answer to that. So that this problem came up. As it stands, the news reports we're seeing now say, no, the rebrand has failed. The rebrand is being mocked. And, you know, I can, you know, only agree with you that, yeah, Axe the Tax has become a bludgeon that one particular political party is using, even though some households, I was reading about this happening in Saskatchewan, are becoming alarmed about what will happen when that money isn't flowing back to them. So the message is maybe kind of starting to go out, but it really is late in the day for that to happen. One thing that I would like to see, and where I think this government or any government, if it wanted to, could do well politically by doing good for people and for the country. The Axe the Tax mantra took on so much more power in late October when the Prime Minister announced that they were suspending the carbon tax in the Atlantic, increasing the heat pump incentive, and specifically focusing their efforts on households that were still stuck with oil heating. It's the most expensive form of heating. These are very often the households with the least financial ability to change that without some form of backstop. And just by the way, oil heating is also the most carbon intensive way to heat your home. There might be others here and there, but you'd have to be really talented. So they were doing the right thing. They got slammed for it because, of course, it opened the door for opposition parties and opposition premiers to say, we now have a two-tiered, what do they call it? A two-tiered home heater, two-tiered tax system, however they put it. So the really obvious response to that is to say, okay, you know what? Strip away the rhetoric. Stop calling us names. And this is one we can actually agree on. What we need is a heat pump incentive for all households, for all geographies, and for all heating types, right? For low and moderate income households. Okay, so if you're in Alberta and you're heating with gas, and by the end of each month, you're choosing between food and fuel, you're in. We get that you're not in the Atlantic and that you're not on oil, but we're extending it, okay? Let's set out to get as far as we can down the road to making energy poverty history so that nobody ever again has to choose between food and fuel. And by the way, if I can articulate any of this, so can they. If it were rocket science, I wouldn't be able to. Now, with the budget coming up, what we have on April 16th, I think, what we have heard from the Minister of Energy and Natural Resources, Jonathan Wilkinson, is that the Greener Homes Energy Retrofit Grant, which has now been discontinued, is going to be replaced by a program that is specifically for low and moderate income households. And what we're hearing from the energy retrofit and energy auditing community, and we're talking about 75,000 jobs here, is yes, absolutely, set up a low income program. We've been begging and urging you to do this for years. Good on you. But don't cut back the program that everybody else needs. Because at this point, we're getting energy retrofits done. We're getting buildings more efficient at about 1/10 the speed we need if we're going to decarbonize our buildings on time. So don't kill off this program that was so successful that it ran through all of its funding in 2.5 years that was meant to last for 7. Recapitalize it and put on the low-income program as well, low and moderate income, so that everyone hears the concept, everyone gets what they need, and along the way, we show some pretty impressive emission reductions. That ended up a bit of a journey, and thanks for being patient with it. It doesn't completely answer it about the carbon price, but what it does do is show Canadians, show households, show voters, show folks that we're actually getting something back for all of this rhetoric, and it's actually probably maybe pretty good for us. One of the people that I interviewed on the Greener Homes Grant, somebody who's just been doing this forever and just does brilliant work, was saying that this is one of the few or possibly the only program in the federal climate agenda that actually brings something back to households. So seriously, why would you kill that off? And that brings me back full circle to what brilliant communicators came up with this, and can we please get them working for the oil industry instead?
We are going to go to a music break, and we'll be back to talk about some good news stories that are happening, which will be a nice change.
The Green Majority is entirely listener-supported, and we would take this opportunity to graciously thank every individual donating to our Patreon page. Thank you very much. We are a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network, home of such podcasts as Alberta Advantage, The Breach Show, and The Pullback Podcast, as well as over 40 other excellent shows.
This section in the middle, we're talking about two pieces of good news that we might be able to tie into four, depending on how well we do. But the first one is the role of energy efficiency to address climate change. And it's been something that's been touted a long time. I remember when the Green Energy Act was coming in here in Ontario, how much conversation there was about the importance of energy efficiency and how much we would be able to save with energy efficiency. I remember seeing the how much cheaper it was to save 1 kilowatt of energy than to find any way to make it. And so this is very exciting. And some new numbers came out that it could be very effective. So can you tell us about the role it can have and how we can get there?
Thank you for that. I'm so glad you want to lead on energy efficiency. So as you were saying, we've known for decades, not years, that energy efficiency is often the single best, single most important thing that we can do to reduce energy costs, to decarbonize, to make the economy as a whole more efficient. You know, it's the gift that just keeps on giving, because you do it once, you get the work done, you get it done right, presumably, you get an energy audit done so that you have the before and after information on how you actually did. And then it's installed for the life of that equipment. You never have to pay for it again. You never have to install it again. And it just keeps on saving money in carbon, which I hear tell are things that we want to do. And it almost never gets the attention or the emphasis that it deserves. It's really important to, you know, sort of pick your level, either maximize efficiency or at least maximize cost effective efficiency, and measure those costs accurately at a time when we are trying to electrify everything in order to shut down fossil fuels. Because how much new renewable energy capacity we need to build, and therefore all of the downstream impacts that people are quite rightly concerned about, those impacts are far less than the impact of the fossil industries, but they are still very real. Okay, how much we need to build depends on how much energy we need to generate, and how much we need to generate depends on how efficiently we're using it. And guess what? Economies pretty much everywhere are desperately inefficient in the way they use energy, and Canada is the worst, or one of the worst, always has been, or has been for as long as I can remember. So what we have been hearing a little while from the International Energy Agency is that by doubling the annual pace at which energy efficiency improves, we can get 50% of the emission reductions that we need by 2030. It's really striking. It's really powerful. And the UN Climate Summit in the United Arab Emirates in December, countries reached consensus, as usual, apart from the fossil fuel transition, which was the big news. On the clean energy side, what got more attention and warranted the attention that it got was the countries agreed to triple renewable energy capacity by 2030. What was often left out of the story, or left out of the headline at least, was that they also took up this IEA recommendation to double the pace of energy efficiency improvements. So that alone, if it's done right, and you know, if it's done in a way that works on the ground, that works for people, then we could save up to, sorry, put that another way, then we could achieve up to 50% of the emissions reduction that we need this decade to stay on track to keep the worst impact of climate change under control. There's a really interesting take on this that forgive me, goes back decades. And you know, spoiler alert, this is the part you're going to want to cut if it goes too long. When I worked at Canadian Renewable Energy News, this would have been around, by this time, it was the early 1980s. And in a hard copy era, we would get news leaks literally in plain brown envelopes. They really did exist. It wasn't just a metaphor. And we got one that we knew came from what we now know was the Department of Natural Resources. It was then the Department of Energy, Mines and Resources, because it was printed on recycled map paper, right? So therefore, we knew that it came from within that department. And it was an analysis that had been done. It was a comparison of the subsidies that the federal and the prime minister and the provincial premiers were then negotiating for the first heavy oil upgrader in Alberta. So this was the birth of the oil sands industry for many practical purposes. They compared that, I think it was like $1 billion or $1.5 billion back in the days when that would buy a mega project. They compared that to the job impact and the energy impact of a national home insulation program that actually worked. And what they basically concluded was that the energy efficiency program would deliver more impact. The benefits would be spread more widely and equitably across the country. But the author predicted correctly that decision makers would choose the oil sands project because what terrified them about the energy efficiency program was that it relied on millions, not thousands, of individual decisions that they couldn't control or anticipate or be responsible for either succeeding or not. And to some extent, I believe that to this day, that's one of the reasons energy efficiency gets downgraded. It's too big and complicated. There is orders of magnitude more being done on it today than there was then. But it isn't nearly enough. And the potential is at 50% by 2030.
Yeah, that's huge. I remember talking to someone out east who was working on a project to try to figure out how you could prefab outsides of houses so that you could do this in a way that would actually scale. Cause like you're right. The scaling challenge here is huge. You know, like the few times I've thought about what a climate corps could do, my idea was basically just to hire 100,000 people, start on the East Coast and make them move slowly west and just have them be doing energy efficiency upgrades in every single building they come across, because it is so hard to coordinate. It's not something that you can just snap your fingers and do. It's not something that you can just do outside of these things. It is thousands and thousands and millions of decisions. And that's not easy to do
for a look at how to organize and how to do that systematically and how to ease that difficulty. Almost 3 years ago now, Efficiency Canada, which is I believe they're efficiencycanada.ca, put out a report on what a national retrofit mission would look like. And it basically talked about how to organize this at the level of the process and the management, because we know what needs to be done. You know, we know how to get buildings to net zero or net zero ready. How to organize that at scale, you know, by the dozen and the hundred and the thousand. That's where a lot of complication is at this point. So, you know, 3 years later, I would still highly recommend that report as an additional reference point. As far as prefab, you know, rather than going on another rant at you, I'm going to suggest we put a pin in that topic and come back to it, because there's some really interesting stuff going on there.
Oh, that's exciting. All right. Well, next month, we're going to get a question from a carrier pigeon asking us to talk about prefab houses, because I may set that up myself. I'll send it out. I'll send out the pigeon itself. It'll come back to me and I'll claim that it came in.
You bet. Somebody please send us a pigeon about prefab, words that I never thought would pass my lips. If anybody out there is still at Harry Potter, send us an owl. We'll get it. You know,
we'll get it. Exactly. So the second piece of good news or solutions, more accurately, is the big opportunity in terms of transportation. And again, it's one of the big ones. Like, we're going, you know, when you talk about emissions, it's energy, it's housing and buildings, and it's waste, and then it's transportation. And so there's a bigger campaign that's sort of gearing up that you can see about the importance of the Fed supporting really getting into supporting public transportation. But can you talk to us about the sort of need and opportunity there?
Sure, thanks. When you look at what is going on in urban areas, and it's where the majority or large majority of Canadians live, not to, you know, talk down or disregard rural areas, but it's where we have the most population concentrated. There's a whole cluster of policies, cluster of you know, just how we change the way cities are organized. That also, you know, my sort of usual broken record, it helps drive down the emissions, but in a way that also makes life better and more efficient, gives us more time in our day, you know, helps us live better and healthier lives. So this report was published by Equitaire, based in Montreal, and Environmental Defense Canada, based in Toronto. We reported on it in just last week. And what they concluded was that the Permanent Public Transit Fund that the federal government has promised and is apparently under development, that that fund could help double transit ridership, and by doing that, reduce emissions by about 65 million tons by 2035. But first of all, the investment has to happen, and there have been some rumblings around town about whether some of the long-term funding that the federal government's been promising will actually materialize in this budget. But then if it does, that there are some specific program features or strings attached that the federal government would have to specify in order to get that doubling in transit ridership and get those 65 megatons of emission reductions. So what we were hearing, things like encouraging housing density near public transit, setting requirements to buy zero emission buses. You know, so if there's funding to buy new buses to replace the old ones that are spending more time in the shop than they are on the road sometimes, if you're in Ottawa, then you get funded. If there's zero emission, you need to take this seriously. Incentives for cities to speed up public transit system, to speed up public transit service with dedicated bus lines. The point about density is really important, and I'll just say quickly that it's important to get it right. The pattern of development in many cities until now has been tall and sprawl. You know, Ottawa just extended the urban boundary 2 or 3 years ago without councillors even having a budget for what it would cost them. So the sprawl part of it is more suburbs, more tract housing, more McMansions. And then the tall is that to get more people into the city, you build 30-story towers. There's a whole approach to missing middle development that is in the 2 to 4 to 8 to maybe 10 stories. That, by the way, is where prefab housing comes in as well, can really contribute, we're hearing. But it's a more pleasant way to live for a lot of people. And the suggestion here is that if you have a transit hub, that's where that added density goes. But there's a loud and I think legitimate strain of advocacy and opinion in the urban sustainability community that says, yeah, definitely densify, but don't lose the fabric and the quality of life in the community, and realize that if you do this right, you can build as many units at that mid-level as you would by building one tower. There's been some really interesting analysis on that, all of which ties back to transit, because then those people living closer to a transit hub become part of the demand that makes it worthwhile to expand transit service and get transit onto this positive cycle rather than the declining cycle where people abandon the system because it's not working so well. So rates go up, quality deteriorates, more people abandon ship. I think this plan is meant to reverse that while we still can.
Yeah, and there are some good signs. You know, recently there were some studies that showed that places like Brampton are seeing huge increases in public transit, and a lot of comebacks have been noted sort of around these efforts. And so there are good news stories in terms of transit.
I love that. We need more good newses. We really do.
We are in the portion of the section where Mitchell takes over and tells me his most important news stories that we have not yet covered. What do you got, Mitchell?
Well, first of all, I mean, as we heard before the break, we have a new section for this, and that is that it's the newses of the month. I think we need to make that a
newses standard. Of the month it is. All right.
I can be persuaded, but I mean, really, you know, let's go with it. Yeah. So I've grabbed a few. You know, and as you say, I mean, there is so much going on in this space that we're never going to do more than just, you know, wave at it briefly. But I think a really important story that's been going around over the last few days, and this one's not a good news story by any means, the Copernicus Lab in the European Union has been following temperature records, both air and ocean temperature records. And we have just come out of the ninth month in a row where global temperatures have been not only at record highs, but alarming highs, you know? And so that is just the background, the context for, it's got to be for everything else that we talk about. And I think it's really important when we tell these stories, you know, whether it's heat, whether it's ice loss, and ice loss is coming along with high heat, of course, whether it's storms and flooding, whether it's, you know, wildfires, it's so important, it's urgent in my mind to recognize that, yeah, this awful stuff's happening. And we know what to do to solve it. We know what to do to fix it. Those solutions are ramping up fast. They're accelerating. The pace of their acceleration is accelerating. And so that doesn't mean we're not in an emergency. We are. We are in the defining crisis of our lifetimes. It doesn't mean we're guaranteed a win. But we really have to keep remembering that the good work is going on. The last chapters of the story have not been written yet, and we really do still have the power to write them. Unless we convince ourselves that all's lost, and that is the only thing yet that makes it a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we give up, yeah, we're done. And we have a lot of hard work ahead of us, but we can, you know, we're very much still in this. And that's where some of the rest of my stories or story picks for the moment go. One is a post that ran on The Conversation, which is an online publication, I think pretty much limited to the academic community. But this was an author from Toronto Metropolitan University saying that renewable energy has been boosting the economy for the last decade. And I think that's really important for us to hear in Canada. And oh, by the way, boosting prosperity, boosting the economy for the last decade, even though the deck has still been stacked in favor of fossil fuels in terms of subsidies, in terms of attention, in terms of support. It's really important, I think, for us all to hear this, to know it, to be sharing it with others, because the dominant belief in Canada, propped up by millions upon millions of fossil industry, you know, you be the judge, PR propaganda, is that as a country, we depend on fossil fuels and there's no alternative. Well, in fact, it turns out that according to, you know, this management studies professor's analysis, that already hasn't been true for a decade. And we know that things are getting better pretty much literally by the minute, as the cost of renewable energy, the cost of batteries, soon the cost of EVs all start plummeting, as investment in the clean alternatives increases, as more and more of these devices start getting installed across Canada and around the world. Just replacing tech with tech is not the whole story. You know, many people in the climate community are quite rightly pointing out that we can't just, you know, replace our way out of this. There's more we need to do as well, but the rest doesn't work without this. So as a first step, it is really essential, and it is gaining momentum as we speak. To that point, the next story that I noticed that we ran this morning is about a battery price war. Again, words that I never thought I would speak, but two of the world's biggest battery manufacturers, both in China, are very quickly driving down the costs of a particular type of electric vehicle battery. And that might sound like a small thing, except that the battery is the most expensive part of the vehicle. And what apparently is now coming up, likely by the middle of this year or a little bit after, is about virtually a 50% price cut in this battery. And it's a battery pack that can be fully charged in less than 30 minutes. So if the two worries about electric vehicles are the price and how long it takes to charge them, then, you know, this kind of change. I mean, I would never rely on one news report from anywhere to say that, okay, fine, this big complicated problem is solved. But it's a really nice indication that the solution's on the way. The next, in a similar vein, is that currently the world's biggest offshore wind farm, Dogger Bank, which is off the coast of Britain in the North Sea, they've already begun generating power, but they have a new phase of the project that is, I believe, just about to go under construction. And there had been talk that instead of supplying electricity to the power grid, that this fourth phase of Dogger Bank would be used to generate green hydrogen instead. And they've just announced that because they now have permission to connect phase four to the grid, or sorry, Dogger Bank D is what they're calling it. Now that they have permission to connect to the grid, they're dropping their plans for green hydrogen and in their world, retiring that part of the project. The reason that's important is that there has been so much interest, so much hype around hydrogen of all varieties. When you hear a reference to green hydrogen, that means that it's being produced from renewably generated electricity. But there are still major complexities with how the hydrogen is transported, how it's used. And there are some truly crazy suggestions out there that hydrogen of any kind can be used for home heating, when just given the physical qualities of the molecule, it's impossible, it's dangerous, it defeats anything else you want to do in a home. But otherwise, hey, sure, why not try it? So if you're going to produce hydrogen, yeah, it should be green hydrogen. But a major high-profile project deciding that if they have a choice, if they have their druthers, they should just do the more efficient thing and feed their electricity into the grid instead of making hydrogen out of it. Again, no one news story changes the scene, but it's a nice indicator. And by the way, quickly, some of the other forms of hydrogen are either so-called blue hydrogen, which is derived from natural gas and depends on carbon capture and storage technology to capture the carbon from the gas and from the production process, when the industry itself admits that carbon capture and storage won't be really ready to deploy properly until at least 2035, when we need solutions by 2030. Gray hydrogen just says, hell with it, we'll just produce it from fossil fuels. So green hydrogen is obviously the best among those options, but we still need to always be using the right and the best clean alternative for each purpose. So as we're saying earlier, that almost always starts with maximizing efficiency, but then the next step is to electrify everything and save green hydrogen for the really complicated uses where we need it. And that makes this decision by Dogger Bank D, which looks to have been made for economic reasons, a really good decision. And then finally, if I have time for one more story?
Quickly, but yes.
Okay, really quickly, we are beginning a series on our senior reporter, Gay Taylor, is slugging away on what is going to be a series on community opposition to large renewable energy projects. There are so many dimensions to this. Some of it is people who are either being funded or inspired by the fossil industry to try to bring down renewables, but it's not just that. We're also hearing, and obviously that's unconscionable, but it's not just that. We're seeing many communications failures. We are seeing listening failures. We're seeing aspects of the way projects have to be developed in order to comply with the rules and regulations that make it difficult for developers to communicate with host communities early enough in the process to start building trust. And I'll just be brief about this one for now. The first story is on our site, but there will be more, and it's something we're all going to need to be paying attention to, because it really is becoming a very large issue, partly again because it's being fomented by a fossil industry that sees its death in renewable energy, but also because there may be some unforced errors going on that we can all be trying to be aware of and solve.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Mitchell. We always appreciate having you here. We will see you again in April for more newses from...
More newses. We need all the newses.
All the newses we can get from the Energy Mix. This has been Mitchell Beer from the Energy Mix. This has been our special episode once a month about all things energy. Thanks so much, Mitchell, and have a wonderful week, everybody.
Have a great weekend, Stefan. Thanks for having me again.
It's not easy.